Hello and welcome to Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashemi. Thanks so much for being with us. Well, Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi, addressing the media on Tuesday, talked about how some countries have continually tried to pressure and isolate Iran. These countries have also tried to destabilize the nation on many occasions. But as they have continued their antagonistic policies, according to the president, Iran has been expanding its development on multiple fronts. Can Iran serve as an example for other countries seeking an independent policy and wanting to choose their own path? Well, we're going to look at this question and others on this Spotlight. I'd like to welcome my guests to the program. Dr. Fuad Izzadi, university professor and political analyst out of Tehran. And Elijah Magnier, journalist and political analyst out of Brussels. Thank you both for being with us. Well, I'd like to start this off in Tehran. The occasion that the president was speaking to the media is known as Government Week. Now, this date was named so after Iran's first president and prime minister were assassinated by terrorists in August of 1981. Iran has been targeted from the beginning of its revolution by hegemonic forces. Why is this the case? Let's start from there. Dr. Izzadi?
Yes. I think the 1979 Islamic Revolution basically was a major blow to U.S. Policy in this part of the world and internationally. The United States sold most of its weapons to the Shah before the revolution. Iran was number one in terms of military purchases in the late 1970s. Iran was in line with U.S. policy in terms of regional enforcement of whatever U.S. wanted to do in West Asia. And at the same time, Amnesty International announced that Iran was number one in those years in terms of torturing political prisoners and killing political prisoners. And so the United States was benefiting from the Shah's regime financially and was supporting a brutal regime. In fact, was responsible for this brutal regime because Shah came back to power in 1953. This year is the 70th anniversary of the 1953 coup d'etat. So when the Islamic Revolution happened in Iran, the United States lost one of its best friends, and it's reasonable that they became upset. They had a chance to correct the wrong policies of the past, but they have continued confronting Iranian people up to today, repeating the failed policies of the past and getting the same results.
What about that, Elijah? You heard what Fuad says, repeating the same failed policies of the past and getting the same results. Why is it that Washington, after all these years, from the revolution in 1979 to 2023, why did they not try to change their technique to get a different result?
Thank you for having me.
Thank you for coming.
It is very simple. Because Iran is committed to support all the oppressed people around the world, because Iran has a lot of natural resources, and it is committed not to submit to the will of the United States, it doesn't mean that Iran doesn't want to deal with the West. Iran is very willing to open up and deal with Europe and the United States, but not on the conditions where Iran needs to submit to the U.S. hegemony. This is something that the U.S. is not used to since the fall of the Soviet Union and in 1981 perestroika. Having a country like Iran facing the United States and rejecting its unilateral hegemony represent a challenge to the U.S. and also set a bad example to all the other countries that have the potentiality to say no to the U.S. Because of that, the United States tried very hard by all means to submit Iran and to offer Iran all the concessions to keep away from having influence in the Middle East or declaring animosity against Israel. When Iran said that we need to concentrate on the commercial side, this is not something that the U.S. is interested in. The U.S. is interested in having political gain and submission from all the countries in the Middle East, as it was the case until very recently when countries started to turn toward each other, and that is mainly due first to Iran rejecting the U.S. and Germany after 43 years of sanctions. Secondly, because of the war that the United States declared with its allies against Russia. So that opened the door for other countries, not only Venezuela, Cuba, but also now we have Russia in the middle. We have the BRICS countries who are allies of the United States, but willing to detach themselves from a unipolar world, and also willing to deal with their own currency. That is a very big hit to the U.S. economy and hegemony. So the Americans look at the world completely differently today because they're no longer in control, because all the model that they have offered in Afghanistan, in Iraq, in Syria, to the Palestinians has failed, and they offer only destruction. Okay. So now Iran is no longer on its own.
Well, Fuad, President Raisi has said that the hegemonic front has failed to isolate Iran. Your take on that, and how is that possible when Washington continues to pressure any country that wants to do business with Iran or tries to support it politically?
You know, a lot of countries have realized that if U.S. Is successful in its anti-policies, then the United States may use the same tactics against those countries. And the fact that we have major countries of the world coming under the BRICS network organization is an indication that the failure of U.S. policies towards Iran is not just the goal of Iranian people. It's the goal of many other countries. Iran, in fact, has become a role model for the resistance movement, both in this part of the world and internationally. And the fact that Iran has been able to not only survive the pressures, but also grow and prosper is an indication that it's possible to resist American hegemony and fight back. And the good news is that the United States is a power in decline. And the fact that you see some of traditionally U.S. allies are joining BRICS is an indication that these countries have realized that the American century has passed, the U.S. influence is declining, and they need to diversify the choices that they have when it comes to international trade and international alliances. So overall, the good news is that this resistance of the last 45 years has paid off, and Iran has been able to basically realize many of the goals of the 1979 Islamic Revolution. It's been quite difficult, but this culture of resistance is something that a lot of Iranians are accepting and following and working towards creating a country that could be a model for others.
Well, you both have just mentioned BRICS. I want to talk about Elijah a little bit more, open that up. But the significance of Iran becoming part of BRICS.
It's a huge significance because Iran today is part of very powerful countries who represent 42% of the world population. Henry Kissinger said, if you control the countries who have the oil and you control the oil, You control nation, but you control food, you control populations. And the BRICS today has the largest number of the population, has the largest number of oil and gas reserves, and has a large number of the food producers. So all that is within countries who are not all willing to stand against the US, but these countries who are seeking business development, commerce, dealing with the local currency, all that is a serious hit to the dollar and to the euro and the British pound. These are the main currency that the world is dealing with, followed by the yuan and all the minor currencies. So by being China in the middle of the BRICS that was created by the Russian, Russia is very determined to keep away from the US because the US has declared indirect war against Russia. The presence of Iran as a major natural resources owner country, it's a major step and an add to the BRICS countries and to Iran. And also that spread a little bit the pressure that the US is exerting on Iran, because now the US needs to think about how it's going to counter the BRICS. I mean, the BRICS is not intended to exclude or antagonize the United States, but it is an invitation for the United States to stop bullying other countries and to think that other countries are finding alternative, particularly when the US has abused of these use of sanctions, sanctioning countries and preventing them from using the SWIFT, selling their products, selling the oil, not even allowing them to buy food and medicine, although they say they're not included, but countries cannot use the SWIFT to deal with other nations. So all this pressure that the US has been exerting on so many nations, we see today that countries like India, like Saudi Arabia, like the Emirates, like Brazil, are willing to come out of the US hegemony, where they have been more or less dominated by the US policy, or at least not daring to stand to the US. By having Iran in it, by also having Venezuela that willing to join, there are 22 other countries who are willing to join in, apart from the six that will be part of the BRICS in January, that will represent a very huge power in the world that's going to talk to the US differently, and the US is going mm-hmm. to really feel afraid of. We're not talking about Europe, because Europe here, everything Europe is doing is against its interest by all means. So we're talking about the United States and the rest of the world, particularly Africa in this case, that is a very fertile ground and willing to come out of the Western dominance and colonialism. So this is why having Iran with all this experience of countering the sanctions, of standing against the US hegemony, having large natural resources and willing to join to the rest of Central Asia and West Asia, and Africa and Latin America, that's very significant.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Okay, well, Fuad, what do you think has been the key to Iran's advancement and determination despite being under crippling sanctions all these years?
I think the people of Iran have realized that the cost of resisting American hegemony is less than the cost of being a client state of the United States. That's why they had the Islamic mm-hmm. Revolution. And although this is 45 years ago, so we have new generations of Iranians, people who were born after the revolution. I think the message of the revolution was transferred to the new generation, and this is one of the successes that the Islamic Republic has had, to be able to have young people who were born 20 years ago, 30 years ago, never saw the difficulties of the first couple of decades of the Iran after the revolution, but still believe in the principles of the revolution and are willing to sacrifice their lives to make sure that the country survives. So the people are going to be very important. This is an Islamic Republic, and so there's a religious component to it. The reason we have people supporting the government is generally religious people are in line with Islamic teachings. So the religion of Islam is contributing. The majority of Iranians are Shias. We are, in the month of Safar, the Arba'in processions are coming. So that culture of resistance is not something that started here in the last few decades. This is a culture that dates back many centuries. It's very much part of the Iranian psyche. So these elements, plus the fact that Iran is a large country, the fact that Iran has a lot of natural resources, the fact that the country's leadership understands how to match the popular support and popular backing with the resources, we have bad governance in many countries. Iran is not immune to bad policies, but overall, the country's government has been able to manage the country, given the fact that Iran has been in a lot of pressure. And then the stupidity of the other side, the fact that they don't learn from mm-hmm. the past mistakes, the fact that they continue to apply the same type of tactics, not realizing that these are not going to work. One of the things that President Raisi said was that a lot of these Western countries thought the riots that we had last year would overthrow the government, not having good analysis on what's actually going on in Iran. So overall, one of the major successes that Iran's government has had is having enemies that don't know how to do foreign policy.
Well, Elijah, at first it was Iran, which was the most sanctioned country in the world. Then other countries were increasingly sanctioned, color revolutions attempted against them. And some of these countries also witnessed attempts to create overall chaos inside of them. Did this become a sign for others and a warning that sooner or later Washington could do exactly what they've done to Iran and others, sanctioning, confiscating funds, and just creating chaos? I mean, did this help just expedite this situation, a solidarity between these nations that are dealing with the hegemonic power?
Indeed, Iran was sitting on the throne of the most sanctioned country in the world with 3,500 sanctions on so many entities, individual companies, everything. And today, it's no longer having the first place. Now it is in the second place because Russia took the first place with over 6,000 sanctions. However, we've seen also countries like China with 650 sanctions, why they are still doing business with the United States. And they understand that it is important to keep this relationship. However, yes, as you rightly said, the reason why people are joining the Shanghai Cooperation and the BRICS nations is because they want to counter the U.S. sanctions, because they want to find an alternative to the dollar, because they're very much willing to deal with their own currency as the BRICS is offering, and because there is a solidarity among countries who are in a neighboring state, like we're talking about the Asia, and we're talking about the whole south of the southern hemisphere, who is collaborating today. And the reason, the main reason why, is because the United States is abusing of the sanction, using it against anyone who stands against the U.S. hegemony. So basically, it is the United, it's thanks to the United States that other countries are finding alternatives,
okay,
seeking for another way to counter the U.S. sanctions and to find a way not to be included under heavy sanction, because we've seen what's happening to Iran. And what happened to Iran is not little. Iran is under heavy sanctions. It is not easy to live with all these sanctions. Of course, the Iranian foreign policy has been extremely well active, and the Iranian local production has managed to create a kind of self-sufficiency. However, Iran cannot live isolated. To break this isolation, Iran is meeting with other countries who are either under sanctions or afraid of the U.S. sanctions that might come,
okay,
including Saudi Arabia.
Stay with me, Elijah. Let me get back to Fuad because I'm running out of time. Sorry to interrupt you. Fuad, your overall assessment of the future of Iran, challenges and possibilities, because we've seen many, many technological advancements that the president actually talked about some of them today. But overall, given the current and perhaps future environment, your overall assessment of Iran?
You know, I think the difficult days have passed. We are sort of moving towards easier days. We are moving towards a multipolar world. In that world, I think we are going to have a block of Western countries or Western clients that are led by the United States. Then you're going to have all these other countries that are not in the Western bloc, and there are going to be some major countries within this second bloc, countries like Iran, Russia, China, that are going to continue to resist the pressures that are coming from the other side. And these countries in the non-Western bloc are going to cooperate with each other, are going to have a common enemy. And in this environment, I think Iran would be able to resist the pressures easier than when you had American hegemony taking over the whole world. So overall, I think the future is bright, and the country is not only going to survive, I think Iran is going to be one of the major countries of the 21st century.
Okay, and unfortunately, I have to end the program, but I appreciate talking to both of you. We're out of time. Dr. Fuad is the university professor and political analyst out of Tehran. Elijah Magnier, journalist and political analyst out of Brussels. And as always, we appreciate you being with us on another Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashemi.
This is A to Z. An introduction into Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, choosing a person to follow in our Islamic lifestyle. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. It's an honor to be here at your service, dear friends. We are talking about an Islamic lifestyle. Now, when talking about an Islamic lifestyle, of course, one of the things that is very important is to follow somebody in our Islamic lifestyle. Now, it might seem something kind of interesting and a little bit strange, but it makes complete sense. if you want to have an Islamic lifestyle, then that means that, well, you're going to have to follow somebody who teaches you that Islamic lifestyle, right? So, of course, the Holy Quran is one of the methods in which we learn our Islamic lifestyle and the various different teachings that the Holy Quran has regarding a Islamic lifestyle. But also, we would need to have a physical human being, an actual role model that we can follow and learn from when it comes to a Islamic lifestyle. Of course, there has to be somebody who embodies this Islamic lifestyle if we are to follow them and truly be able to live a Islamic lifestyle. Now, as you would have already guessed, of course, that role model is primarily the Messenger of Allah, the Holy Prophet Muhammad, sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi. So he is the primary role model, and after the Holy Prophet, peace and blessings upon him and his holy household, of course, the other role models are the 12 divinely appointed imams, and of course, Lady Fatimatu Zahra, alayha salam. As well as the other members of the Ahlul Bayt, alayhim as-salam, peace and blessings upon them, that are considered to be a role model for every single one of us. And it is they who, being a role model, will teach us and show us what truly a Islamic lifestyle is. Welcome back. This is A to Z on IRIB English Radio. So, dear friends, we are talking about how to live a Islamic lifestyle. Now, of course, when we are living a Islamic lifestyle, as we had said in the previous segment, we are going to have somebody to follow, to emulate as a role model. Now, of course, the Holy Quran, if we say, is a book which has all the guidelines, right? This is the silent book, if you will. But there is also a speaking book. In the Arabic, it is known as the Quranun Natiq, the speaking Quran. And who is this speaking Quran? Well, we talked a little bit about it in the previous segment. The speaking Qurans are the Messenger of Allah, sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi, as well as the divinely appointed imams, the Ahlul Bayt, alayhimus salam, peace and blessings upon them, and of course, Lady Fatimatu Zahra, alayha salam. These are the speaking Qur'ans. These are the Qur'an in physical embodiment. And so we take them as our role models in order to be able to live a Islamic lifestyle. And truly, they are the ones who embodied the most perfect, the most pure, and the most complete Islamic lifestyle imaginable. But what about the present day? In a day and in an age and an era in which the imam of our time is in ghaiba, he is in occultation, what do we do? Well, first and foremost, we have the Holy Quran. Second, we have the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salam, in which we can follow. But then there are the righteous religious scholars in the present day, whom are the embodiment of the teachings of those role models that we spoke about. They are the embodiment of the teachings of the Holy Quran, and they are the embodiment of the teachings of the Messenger of Allah and the Ahlul Bayt, peace and blessings upon them all. And so, of course, we have these various maraji, these sources of emulation in the present day, whom we can actually look at physically and listen to physically and be able to live that Islamic lifestyle. Of course, the foremost amongst these religious scholars of the greatest caliber, of course, is Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei. But of course, Imam Khomeini was a great role model. And there are other maraji taqlid, Ayatollah Sistani, and various other religious scholars whom we can see physically, and we can follow them when it comes to a Islamic lifestyle.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parstoday.ir.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Aminolemi, Kabul.
Shahanabad, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
And consumer protection. And Mr.
It has been named Digital Services Act, or DSA, and it is the European Union new law designed to tackle hate speech and fake news online. But it is much more than that. The DSA, which came into effect on August 25, stipulates that online platforms with more than 45 million monthly active users will have to take off illegal content, hate speech, and so-called disinformation from their platforms, or they will face fines of up to 6% of their annual global turnover.
As it occurs for many other EU laws, the DSA's real objectives seem to be hidden, while it is clear that the risk the EU could abuse this mechanism is worrying indeed. My concern is that people's rights that have been so far protected by our constitution may be circumvented by lackluster provisions.
More than 40 online giants, including Google, Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube, must now comply with the new legislation, which will force them to be legally accountable for everything from fake news to manipulation of shoppers, government propaganda, and criminal activity, including child abuse. But a question remains open. Who decides what counts as real or fake news? And who decides what is and is not disinformation?
This is the real issue. Who decides what disinformation is? According to the ACT, this decision will be made arbitrarily by some EU officials with the help of trusted flaggers, bodies of people entitled to tip the authorities off. Which bodies? Which people? In my view, this whole legislation was designed to contain growing dissent in the EU.
Many in Italy, including some political organizations, newspapers and individuals, have expressed deep concerns over the DSA. Even the head of the League's delegation to the EU Parliament, Marco Campomenosi, has warned the DSA is likely to strengthen censorship on the internet. The League is one of Italy's coalition government parties. On the heels of the DSA, also a new European Digital Markets Act has recently come into effect. The provision is designed to regulate competition between large and smaller companies. Tech giants, for instance, will no longer be allowed to rank their own products or services higher than those of their competitors for the sake of consumers or end users, the EU says. The regulation of the Digital Services Act will be overseen by the European Commission itself, not by an independent regulator. The implications for freedom of expression are obvious and ominous. Max Civili, Rome. ¶¶
On August 29, 2021, as the U.S. was withdrawing its forces tumultuously, their drones were flying over Kabul to maintain security. A car suspected of carrying bombs was placed under surveillance. After a tiring day, Zumaray, the owner of the car, returned home to find peace with his family. As he parked the car in the yard and his children rushed to greet him, the man behind the joystick and his superiors made the fateful decision that this was the best time to act. Zumaray and nine members of his family were tragically killed in the airstrike carried out by American forces on that day. Seven of the victims were innocent children under the age of 12. The youngest was only 2 years old. Zumaray himself was a relief worker who had spent the last day of his life distributing food among needy people in Kabul. During the U.S. withdrawal, which took almost 2 weeks, Afghan people witnessed countless brutalities and painful events. Ruhullah and Ahmad say that the bitter memories of those days will remain with them forever, etched in their minds as a reminder of the suffering they endured.
I remember the chaos those days. The explosion near the airport and the drone attack on that car were heartbreaking. This is what we saw during the entire presence of the U.S. here. Death and destruction, but no benefit.
The innocent children that they did not know anything about policy, they didn't know anything about government, they didn't know anything about life, but they are being killed, and it's really mournful for me and also for all citizens of Afghanistan.
Back the fuck up!
During the 15-day pullout of U.S. forces, many people were killed either directly by the Americans or indirectly through their negligence. Some by falling off American planes, many in a suicide attack near the Kabul airport, and some by American missiles inside their own home. Most experts believe that the U.S. is to blame for these lost lives.
As the U.S. was withdrawn, they intentionally made a false announcement claiming that they would take as many Afghans abroad as possible. This caused many people to rush to the airport in hopes of being taken to safety. The U.S. had several motives for this action, but the most important one was to show the world that the people of Afghanistan wanted them here in an attempt to justify their 20-year presence in the country. However, chaos quickly spiraled out of control, resulting in the tragic loss of many lives.
A day after the airstrike, the Pentagon spokesperson said that the civilians were probably killed by a second explosion, but experts proved that there was only one explosion from the missile. American authorities simply got over with the case by saying it was a mistake and that they were sorry, yet no one was fired or even demoted. Abdullah Hamirzadeh, Kabul.
On August 30, 1981, a briefcase bomb exploded in the office of Mohammad Javad Bahonar, then Prime Minister of Iran, which killed him and then President Mohammad Ali Rajoi, along with six other government officials, as the entire first floor of the Prime Minister's office was destroyed. Rajoi and Bahonar had won the elections in a landslide victory, receiving an overwhelming 91% of the ballots. Hundreds of thousands of Iranians attended the funeral, marking yet another deadly attack carried out by the terrorist Mujahideen Khalq organization, who has the blood of 17,000 Iranians on its hands. The tragic event has ever since been marked as Government Week on the Iranian calendar. And today, the empty seat of Shahid Rajoi graces an exhibition set up to mark the occasion, showcasing the achievements of President Ebrahim Raisi's administration.
The Raisi administration has made great achievements over the past 2 years. In foreign policy, for example, you can see that our country has become a member of the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, and just a few days ago, BRICS announced that it will be accepting Iran as a full member. We have also resumed diplomatic relations with countries such as Saudi Arabia. These are very important steps taken by the government.
As far as domestic policy is concerned, issues particularly pertaining to women and families have been high on the agenda. Social security, health care, and retirement plans are now in place for stay-at-home moms, particularly those living in small cities and villages. Mothers with more than three kids have been prioritized. This is all in line with the policy to provide support for families. Also, the budget we needed has been allocated to small business loans for women who are the sole providers of their families and want to start a business. But it's not just women who are receiving government support. Knowledge-based companies have also been on the list, many of them active in agriculture, industry, and healthcare sectors.
We specialize in manufacturing industrial flow meters. We have recently produced a highly accurate ultrasonic flow meter, and the Ministry of Energy can use it in various infrastructural projects.
Iran's public and private sectors have joined hands for the country to prosper, and the exhibition held on the occasion of Government Week this year clearly reflects that.
Over the past decades, Iran has taken major steps towards sustainable development, despite Western pressure and unilateral sanctions. And now this occasion is an opportunity for the entire nation to look forward to a brighter future. Gisumish Ahmadi, Tehran.
Amid widespread anger over the disturbing trend of Quran desecrations across Scandinavia, the Danish government has announced plans to criminalize public mistreatment of religious objects. The new laws would permit police to act if holy scriptures, including the Quran, the Bible, or the Torah, are physically violated.
The Danish authorities' promise to change the law has been well received by many Muslim onlookers. However, there is still a lot of concern surrounding the reasons behind why this decision may be implemented. The idea that Denmark is facing a major threat from the Muslim world, rather than, for example, admitting that their freedom of speech argument is flawed, that is in itself suspect and could even be an indication or a message to the Muslim world that Denmark is not willing to adopt any responsibility for the vile desecrations and offence that have been caused. Rather, they're seeking to place blame once again on the Muslim community itself for the reasons behind this law change.
On Saturday, local Danish Muslims gathered in a show of strength to continue the pressure in hopes of the law change proposal becoming a reality. Danish coalition officials said they could enact the policy as soon as the end of the year if it is approved by Parliament. According to a draft of a bill published by the Danish Justice Ministry, those found guilty of mistreating an object with major religious significance could be fined or sentenced to up to 2 years in prison. Both Denmark and neighbouring Sweden have struggled to defend the West's free speech argument, finally wilting in the face of international condemnations. The Quran desecrations infuriated the Muslim world, sparking massive protests across the globe. Rather than owning up or apologising for their defence of hate speech, Denmark's leaders have said that the national security was the primary motivation for the ban. This was the excuse they've used for the law change. While some Muslims have been left disappointed with this reasoning, some celebrate the development as a victory in the war against Islamophobic hate speech. Robert Carter, Copenhagen.
Cesium-137, Iran's new solution for radioactive waste management and a leap forward in nuclear medicine, not to mention its many applications in industrial gauges. The Atomic Energy Organization of Iran made the announcement while unveiling the homegrown radioisotope, which is currently produced at laboratory scales.
What's important to know is that cesium-137 itself is a strategically important product. With a half-life of about 30 years, it has various applications. It plays a key role in industrial gauges, for example, particularly in our oil and gas sector, and in order to measure the flow of fluids accurately. Also, for the calibration of industrial measuring tools, its long half-life is a great advantage. To that, I should add its various applications in nuclear medicine, in both diagnosing and treating cancer.
But most importantly, Iran now has a team of experts that are capable of recycling nuclear waste and producing radioisotopes while observing international standards and all the necessary regulations in accordance with IAEA safeguards. This becomes even more significant when taking into consideration a number of other radioisotopes found in nuclear waste, which can also be derived and applied in the sectors of healthcare, agriculture, and industry, as head of Iran's Atomic Energy Organization explained.
It is essential that we have been able to meet the needs of our society as far as this type of state-of-the-art technology is concerned. We were able to do so as a member of the IAEA that complies with its regulations and safeguards.
Head of Iran's Atomic Energy Organization added that Iran has now gained a foothold in this sector. He said not only will he be attending the upcoming IAEA General Conference in Vienna, but Iran will be holding its first exhibition there as well.
The production of cesium-137 is the result of 6 months of hard work. But Iran's Atomic Energy Organization says it is not stopping there. And very soon we will be hearing more news about the production of more radioisotopes, particularly from nuclear waste. Gizumisha Ahmadi, Tehran.
Al-Bayouk family, who lives in one of the most marginalized areas in southern Gaza Strip, Qizan Rishwan, is the main supporter of the talented son Mohammed as he's pursuing his dream. The 13-year-old boy was elected to participate in the football contest in Tunisia, but his permit to leave the besieged Gaza Strip was denied by the Israeli authorities. But when he managed to leave the region and participated in the tournament, Mohammed did his best for his country.
My son, along with his teammates from the besieged Gaza Strip, got the chance to compete in the Norway Cup finals against four countries with 43 teams. I knew that my son is talented, but I just was able to support him with what was available due to the economic situation in the besieged Gaza Strip. It wasn't easy for me as a father of four to provide food and equipment needed to improve his physical condition and skills. Sometimes I couldn't buy him football shoes due to high prices, so he had to play with low-quality second-hand ones or to borrow from our friends and neighbors.
It was Friday noon and the whole family gathered to watch the match. I was praying for him. It was a tough match, especially in the extra time, and it was my son who scored the golden goal that qualified them for the finals. I was happy for him that he managed to leave Gaza to participate in the Norway Cup, but at the same time, I was concerned for his safety. But thankfully, they came back with the cup, and they raised the Palestinian flag in the world. The passion for playing football has grown fast, and 2 years ago, he had the chance to sharpen his skills when he joined the Youth Stars Center, where he used to train with low-quality equipment.
I love football so much. Despite the cancelling of our trip to Tunisia by the Israeli occupation, I made it up to Norway and won the cup, where I scored 5 goals. I wish we had big stadiums like those I played there. Here, I play at the pitches with poor quality. I wish I could join Real Madrid club one day and play like Luka Modric. I wish I could visit Portugal, Spain, France and Denmark. I've shown the whole world that even if we suffer from the Israeli occupation in the besieged Gaza Strip and don't have the chance like other children around the world and don't enjoy our full rights, despite all that, we're resilient and we try our best.
Israel always interferes in the Palestinian sports affairs. It denies entry of equipment needed for different sports. Palestinian athletes face arrest and travel bans when they have to participate in a tournament. Israeli suffocating blockade is destroying sports facilities in the Gaza Strip. The Palestinians in the Gaza Strip have demonstrated a strong determination to stand up against occupation, blockade, and poverty. The young Palestinians have understood that this is their only hope to gain international support. Despite the overwhelming odds that Palestinians endure in the Gaza Strip, a glimpse of hope shines through the most impoverished areas in defiance, telling the whole world that there is on this land whatever makes life worth living. Ula Al-Asib, Gaza.
Cancer patients in Gaza staged a sit-in protest to condemn the Israeli blockade that has taken its toll on their lives. After being diagnosed with cancer, patients in Gaza have to wait for months before they even can access treatment. Hospitals in Gaza grapple with a severe shortage of medicines, particularly those vital for cancer patients. The journey to receive crucial life-saving medical care is fraught with numerous obstacles for cancer patients in Gaza. Israeli restrictions on freedom of movement have prevented Palestinian patients with serious illnesses from seeking urgent medical treatment beyond the blockaded territory.
Lack of medical equipment and Israeli obstacles are hurting cancer patients. Doctors here are tirelessly working to help us, but the resources are limited. I have throat cancer, and my treatment is not always available in Gaza. I call on all the people around the world to help alleviate our suffering.
Currently, cancer patients in Gaza suffer from acute shortage of the essential drugs needed for their treatment, experiencing a staggering 60% deficit rate. Under the current circumstances, the health condition of many cancer patients is likely to deteriorate further. Israeli authorities also impose a ban on the entry of medical devices and equipment into the Gaza Strip, further weakening the provision of health services to cancer patients.
The worst obstacle facing us is the lack of medicines, especially chemotherapy and radiation therapy supplies for cancer patients. The number of cancer patients in Gaza is very high, and with the current shortages, we can't treat all of them.
The health sector has been grappling with critical shortage of medicines and medical equipment due to the Israeli blockade in place since 2007.
Health officials are calling on the international community to help end the shortage of medicines in the besieged Gaza Strip and save the lives of Palestinian patients. Ashraf Shana, Gaza.
August 30th, National Day of Combating Terrorism. August 30th is the National Day of Combating Terrorism in the Islamic Republic of Iran. On this day in 1981, a major terror attack resulted in the martyrdom of two icons of the Islamic Revolution and top officials of the Islamic Republic, namely Martyr Muhammad Ali Rajai, the president of Iran at the time, and Martyr Muhammad Javad Bahonar, the prime minister at the time. In this special program, we look at how terrorism has been used as a tool by the enemies of the Islamic Revolution to try to uproot the newly established Islamic Republic in the early years of the revolution. Please stay with us. The Islamic Republic of Iran is one of the most prominent victims of terrorism in the world today, with over 17,000 Iranians falling victim to terror attacks since the victory of the Islamic Revolution in February of 1979. Both ordinary Iranians and senior officials of the country have borne the brunt of these terrorist attacks. One of the most notorious of these terrorist attacks occurred on 30th of August 1981, when the Islamic Republic was just a fledgling state. On that day, in a massive bomb attack, the Iranian president, Muhammad Ali Rajai, and prime minister at the time, Muhammad Javad Bahonar, together with a number of other senior officials and their entourage, were assassinated in a terrorist attack. This incident took place exactly 2 months after another terrorist attack, in which the head of Iran's judiciary, Ayatollah Sayyid Mohammad Hosseini Beheshti, and over 70 senior officials, including members of Iran's parliament and top officials of the Islamic Republic political party, were assassinated in another massive bomb attack and explosion at the party headquarters. Martyr Muhammad Ali Rajai was 48 years old when he was assassinated. After the victory of the Islamic Revolution, Rajai first became the Minister of Education and in 1980 he was elected to Parliament, the Majlis, or the Islamic Consultative Assembly, representing the people of Tehran. On 11th of August 1980, he was appointed as Prime Minister. After the collapse of the government of President Abul Hassan Bani Saad, who was voted out of office when MPs in Parliament, in a motion of no confidence, removed him from office, Muhammad Ali Rajoy became a presidential candidate and garnered over 13 million votes and became the second president of the Islamic Republic of Iran, winning the elections of 24th of July 1981. Prime Minister Mohammad Javad Bahonar was also 48 years old when he was martyred in 1981. After the victory of the Islamic Revolution, he held a number of senior posts such as representing the people of Kerman in the Assembly of Experts, being a member of the Council of the Revolution, representing the people of Tehran in the Iranian Parliament, the Majlis, Minister of Education in President Mohammad Ali Rajoy's cabinet, and the General Secretary of the Islamic Republic Political Party after the martyrdom of Dr. Hosseini Beheshti in June of 1981. He was appointed to the post of Prime Minister by President Rajoy after he won the presidential election, which was held on 24th of July 1981. The enemies of the Islamic Revolution have, throughout the past 45 years, carried out all sorts of terrorist attacks and assassinations, hoping to destroy the Islamic Republic. But the Iranian people have carried on the path of the martyrs, remaining true to the ideals and objectives of the Islamic Revolution and the Islamic Republic. The anti-Iran terrorist group MKO, since its founding in 1965, has carried out myriad terror attacks and has been involved in numerous anti-Iran activities, such as helping the former Iraqi dictator Saddam in his 8-year war against Iran, carrying out bomb attacks within Iran, assassination and terror of senior Iranian officials as well as ordinary Iranians, and declaring war against the Islamic Republic. Today, this terrorist group is based in Albania and is fully backed by the United States of America. In fact, the US government decided to provide financial, political, media and intelligence support to the MKO terrorists from the early years of the Islamic Revolution onwards, fully backing their criminal and terrorist activities inside Iran. The MKO uses violence and terror to physically eliminate or assassinate key officials, politicians, experts, scientists and engineers, such as Iran's nuclear scientists and nuclear engineers, hoping to paralyze Iran's industry in this way. Their ultimate aim is to collapse and destroy the Islamic Republic. The martyrs of 28th of June, Shohadai Haftum Tir, the martyrs of 30th of August, Shohadai Hashtum Shahrivar, the martyred religious leaders and personalities, known as Shohadai Mehrab, and individuals such as Major General Qarani, Brigadier General Sayyad Shirazi, Sayyid Asadullah Lajavardi, were all assassinated by MKO terrorists. Far from condemning these terror attacks, the arrogant powers led by the United States of America actually supported and encouraged these terror attacks. From the point of view of international law, the MKO has indiscriminately killed ordinary Iranian citizens as well as senior government officials, terrorizing the population at large and infringing upon Iran's sovereign territory. International law leaves no doubt as to the nature of these attacks. These are all acts of terrorism, pure and simple, and the Geneva Conventions of 1949, as well as the International Convention for the Suppression of Terrorist Bombings, adopted by the United Nations General Assembly on 15th of December 1997, and the International Convention Against Taking of Hostages, adopted by the United Nations